IVM.
Linda Buck, the American biologist, was incredibly relieved. She and her research collaborator Richard Axel had been trying their hardest to figure out how humans identify different odors for years. They had tried everything, she said, and were basically at a dead end. Until 1991, when they made a huge breakthrough and discovered a large number of previously unmapped human genes, the olfactory system superfamily, comprising up to 1,000 genes or 3% of the entire human genome, the study had tremendous implications for how humans perceive the highly interlinked senses of smell and taste. It was pioneering work, hugely influential to establishing the scientific basis of flavor, and it resulted in their getting the Nobel Prize for Physiology in 2004. But for an area of relatively recent scientific breakthrough, flavors are, of course, actually a quite ancient field of cultural knowledge and commerce.
For our prehistoric counterparts, differentiating between tastes like sweet and bitter could have meant the difference between life and death from poisoning. But they were innovators too. Dating back to prehistoric times, humans relied on herbs and spices to enhance the flavor of food. Among many examples of food-forward ancient civilizations, the ancient Egyptians used spices like dill and sweeteners like honey. As time wore on, the quest for spices and flavors became one of the earliest drivers of globalization, sometimes with devastating consequences. As one of the first globally traded products, spices were extremely expensive worldwide and were a major reason for colonial powers extending their influence to Asia. Columbus, of course, famously sailed to the Americas in 1492 on a quest for a quicker route to India and its plethora of spices.
Fast forward to today, and the world of flavors and food chemistry is better known and more exciting than ever before. As food dominates our lives and technology marches on, the amount of data that we have about our food likes and dislikes, or preparation or even consumption, is mind-boggling. From simple aspects like flavor components to creating databases of chemical compounds that inform our food chemistry, there is a lot of data that can help us understand the food we eat and its cultural underpinnings. This data has the ability to shape our culinary habits and preferences and drive innovative product development in sectors like plant-based and cultivated or cell-based meat.
But several questions and mysteries remain. Really simple, fundamental ones too. Like that map of the tongue with neat sections for different tastes. It's been repeatedly debunked for years. So how do we leverage all this technology, all this data, to solve questions as complex as creating really good plant-based salmon versus cod versus pomfret? Our guest today may have some answers. Dr. Ganesh Bagler heads the Complex Systems Laboratory in IIIT Delhi, or the Indraprastha Institute of Information Technology. He has been at the forefront of this emerging field of data science as applied to food pairing, culinary fingerprints and flavor profiles, and its impact on health, diseases and recipes from across the world. I'm Ramya Ramurthy, the communication specialist of the Good Food Institute India.
And I'm Varun Deshpande, managing director at the Good Food Institute India. And you're listening to Feeding 10 Billion. Dr. Bagler, welcome to the show.
Thank you. And it's my pleasure to be here on the show.
So as a first question, Dr. Bagler, could you tell us how you apply machine learning and artificial intelligence to something like imparting flavor to our food?
When we look at food and flavors, what we see is a lot of data. My field, which I've been pioneering in my lab for a long time, we have been building algorithms and databases, investigating various aspects of food, the jigsaw pieces of the food puzzle, as I call it. Those are recipes, flavors, nutrition, and health aspect of it. And while doing so, we have gathered a lot of data about the foods, ingredients and flavors and have put them together. And when you collect and curate a large amount of data, you can apply techniques and tools of machine learning and artificial intelligence for asking questions such as what makes meat special, what makes seafood special in terms of their flavor coordinates. And in a similar manner, how can you predict at a molecular level the taste of a molecule, whether it is bitter or sweet? Such are the kind of questions that we are asking as part of computational gastronomy paradigm to use machine learning and artificial intelligence and leverage them.
So in layman terms, you know, we're talking about novel combinations, ingredients and flavors. For someone like me who is quite a, you know, avid home chef, in our kitchens, we toss some mustard seeds and hing or asafoetida into a saucepan and, you know, add some ghee or oil. And that tempering informs the flavor of a wide range of cuisine, especially in India. Mm-hmm. And if you add curry leaves, that's pretty much the dominant spice in the southern states. How does one extrapolate the scientific process that is happening at this small scale in all our kitchens to what you are trying to accomplish with your work?
Well, that's a wonderful question from a layman's perspective. I must say that when one talks about making cooking and culinary art into science, people don't just get it. How can you actually make a science out of it? So when we started looking at recipes and cuisines, we started looking at them from a combinatorial perspective. What we said is that recipes that we see today, contemporary recipes, have evolved over a long period of time of the order of a few thousands of years, right? And we wanted to understand them from a combination perspective. And we looked at one of the hypotheses that has been standing out there called the food pairing hypothesis, which says that recipes typically would tend to have ingredients that are of similar flavor. And incidentally, in a 2011 paper, it was shown by investigating recipes and ingredients and their flavor molecules that indeed the Western cuisines, broadly speaking, the Latin American, North American and European cuisines tend to have a blend of ingredients that are very, very similar to each other. We may call them as uniform blend of ingredients. Compared to that, when we investigated the Indian recipes across the length and the breadth of the countries, eight geocultural cuisines, their ingredients and their flavor molecules, what we found is that to us that time it was initially surprising that the Indian recipes tend to have a contrasting blend of ingredients. Well, that's the way you look at this science to understand from a layman's perspective, that what kind of a typical pattern you would find in a recipe in terms of blend of flavor, blend of ingredients. Broadly speaking, it means that a typical Indian recipe would be a potpourri of flavors as opposed to a typical Western recipe.
And this is even within a very small region, not just across India.
Oh, yes. Incidentally, we looked at each regional cuisine, that such as Maharashtrian, South Indian cuisine, Bengali cuisine, Rajasthani cuisine, etc. And we find that this pattern is pretty consistent and is not washed out when you look at only regional recipes per se. And that was interesting for us. And to an extent, we also found that a cuisine which has been imported into India from other part of the world, such as Mughlai cuisine, has a lesser extent of food pairing compared to the rest of the aboriginal cuisines of South Asian subcontinent, right? That way, we were very pleased to find what we found at that point of time.
So you've created multiple culinary fingerprints of this kind, right? Of different nations and regions all across the world. I think when we first met, I heard you describe the Indian cuisines as having a molecular fulcrum, which is basically spices. Right. So when you look at spices and how they change across the entire subcontinent, mm-hmm. the things that tend to change recipes the most are when you swap different spices out. It enters an entirely different family of culinary delights, right?
Indeed. Couple of things here. One is that we noticed that looking at cuisines and recipes only from food pairing perspective was a little monotonous view of recipes. And therefore, we started looking at all other kind of patterns in them. And by putting all of these patterns together, we could actually found out what is the quintessential character of a cuisine. And that's what we named as a culinary fingerprint. Like you have a DNA fingerprint, which uniquely identifies who you are, in the same manner, the culinary fingerprint of a cuisine tries to find the essence of a cuisine. It tries to tell what kind of a patterns of ingredient combinations, flavor combinations that make the cuisine what it is. And coming to the spices part, when we did this experiment of figuring out what would happen if you were to shuffle, let's say, vegetables, keeping everything else same, only vegetables are being completely randomized or shuffled in a layman parlance. And what we found is that if you were to shuffle vegetables or shuffle fruits or other category of ingredients, the food pairing pattern doesn't change much. Whereas if you were to shuffle spices, turns out that the food pairing pattern changes dramatically, suggesting that the exact placement of a spice in Indian recipe is rather critical. And thereby, we proclaimed that spices are the molecular fulcrum of the Indian cuisines or Indian recipes for that matter.
That's fascinating. And actually goes against how a lot of people possibly outside India view Indian cuisine, right? They just see it as a mishmash of spices where you just throw whatever in and it'll all taste the same. And there's this sense that you just add garam masala to everything, ho jayega. But clearly, your work shows that that's not true. In fact, it's like having a DNA fingerprint of a dish that can be vastly different if you just change one small ingredient.
Indeed. In fact, the chefs were supremely excited when we came up with this result, and chefs who were cooking with Indian cuisine and knew the relevance of placement of the spices actually came and thanked me, saying that, "Professor Bagler, thanks for doing this research. We knew intuitionally what you are telling me, but at the same time, showing it in a scientific manner and quantifying this result has a huge value in terms of placing the Indian cuisine's relevance in a worldwide context."
So going one level deeper than recipes, which is what we've been discussing, which is looking at the very fundamental chemical underpinning of certain foods, certain specific meats, let's say, for example. Right now, there isn't a great deal of knowledge globally, let's say in seafood, which we talked about what it actually means to be a salmon, to be a cod, to be a pomfret, to be a basa, all of these things, all of these different fish, and then, of course, shrimp, lobster, etc., etc., from a flavor standpoint. There are molecules, there are proteins, there are amino acids, there are different chemical compounds within meat that give it its unique flavor and in different ratios. Is there any work currently underway in India or elsewhere that you've seen that really fascinates you in this area and is promising?
My understanding is that when we created this database called FlavorDB, is that the information available for fish and seafood in terms of their flavor profile is very much limited. In fact, we had to live with the fact that there is something called a fishy smell in general attached with all fishes, and that generic smell is what we had to put it in our database. So in my understanding, the data is pretty limited, and going by the objectives towards which you want to move at GFI, where you would like to create plant-based food as well as clean meat, right? Understanding is pretty much limited. And I believe studies such as gas chromatography, which tries to identify what is a characteristic flavor of a given ingredient, especially seafood and fish, is much desired for. It is not done as much as we would like it to be done.
The second question leading on from that I wanted to ask you, and it requires a little bit of preamble, right? So we get a ton of entrepreneurs coming to us or just talking out there in the world about how they're creating databases of food. Unfortunately, this is something that requires a ton of funding, because if you think about the complexity involved here, it's orders of magnitude more than we can currently fathom. Because as you said, with recipes, when you swap out a spice, it's not just swapping out the spice, it's swapping out the order in which things are cooked, swapping out the ratio in which ingredients are added, swapping out the moisture, swapping out the heat, the exact temperature. And of course, Ramya, you asked the question about, you know, home chefs having sophistication, but when you're looking to make the perfect iteration of something, and when you're making new products like plant-based and cultivated or cell-based meat, it has to be the perfect iteration to replace what it is replacing. You have to get it perfectly right. So to what extent do you think entrepreneurs can actually solve this problem? Wouldn't it be something that's totally captured by the huge flavors companies?
Well, what I think is this, that flavor companies are doing their bit by investigating the flavors of various ingredients that they are interested in personally. But if you are asking about the funding is required if you want to do experimental work and you would like to dissect recipes and try to do all kind of combinations, etc. All I could tell you is this, that what we have been doing in our lab in terms of dissecting recipes to the smallest of the nuts and bolts of the recipes, right? So there is something called RecipeDB, which is yet to be published, but I had already shared this information with you about recipes across the world. We have more than 118,000 recipes from across the world belonging to around 26 regions and 84 countries. And these have been broken down into their ingredient section, what is the unit quantity, what is the state of it, and dryness and freshness, all the way up to the cooking instructions. In my opinion, the analytical side of the work is something that we are fitting in. Entrepreneurs would have to come in and would have to do a lot of experimentation with the meat-based foods and do literally cooking to find out what works and what doesn't work to be able to come up with the final solutions, as I understand.
Yeah, that makes sense. And to be clear, I think the flavors companies are doing fantastic work in this area. So if you look at, let's say, International Flavors and Fragrances, IFF, or Firmenich, or Givaudan, these are all American or European companies that have existed for a long time. They started out as perfumery or fragrance companies, and then of course a natural step was to get into flavor. So Givaudan just released a bit of news that they're working with Bühler which is it makes extrusion manufacturing machines. To figure out at exactly what stage in the extrusion process, you have to add chicken flavor to make a perfect plant-based chicken.
Wonderful.
Because this kind of optimization has not been done before, and it underscores how early our sector actually is. And all the noise that's been made, all the sexy launches that have happened thus far are just the tip of the iceberg in terms of what's possible.
Get that.
But can we back up a bit? Because I feel like we've gone a little ahead. I'd actually like to understand from you, for our sector, when we're trying to make protein-rich foods that mask off-tones of their source material mm-hmm. or have ingredients that perfectly mimic the taste and smell and flavor of meat, when it comes to plant-based food especially, what are the biggest challenges in this process and how do you, you know, create a plant-based meat that mimics meat the best?
Any food, prepared food, would have multiple sensory components involved. Taste, odor, texture, color, and other factors also if you were to count in. What I see is that we need to understand the taste and the odor part of it in a very, very clear manner, which means collection of a huge amount of data from cooked and processed food to be able to understand what goes inside it in terms of flavor molecules. Notice that this is a synergistic effect that eventual cooked product would have. So under certain processes, what kind of molecules would interact with each other? It's not only the list of molecules, which is what we have been able to compile so far, but what is the concentration of each molecule, what level it is interacting with our molecular machinery in our body in terms of taste and odor, thereby we sensing it. Right? All of these factors will count in. So as I understand, we need to prioritize the food products that we would like to imitate in the first place and try to figure out what is it that in the meat product that gives that special flavor because of which you would like to accept a plant-based food as almost close to that of the meat and mimic it, right? A collection of large amount of data and cataloging it is what is heavily required at the moment.
Okay. And when, you know, we discussed a bit about the different flavors of seafood and how you differentiate between a cod or a pomfret. We've had Shiok Meats on the show earlier in our season, and they're trying to cultivate shrimp from cells. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to something like that, can your work on flavor compounds actually inform how they develop a shrimp tasting or a shrimp product?
The data that we have, as I said, is pretty limited to be able to go down to the specific ingredient at the moment. But I believe that with the amount of data that we can gather, which is what I'm proposing at the moment we should be doing, data analytics is going to be eminently useful in trying to achieve the exact tones of the odor and the flavor that we would like to from any given plant-based food. So yes, it's not only my work per se, but I'm trying to point at that data-driven analytics of the data that you gather from experimental studies such as mass spectroscopy and gas chromatography are going to be eminently useful in reproducing the flavor that we desire.
Yeah, and to be clear, we were just talking about, we actually talked about this just before this recording, about cultivated meat, right? Cell-based shrimp and things like that. So I think the understanding right now in the industry is that to a great extent, the cells would just express the molecules and the proteins and the amino acids, etc., that they need to be flavored like shrimp because they are shrimp cells. But I'm certain that the work that you're doing, Dr. Bagler, and collaborations between your lab and those entrepreneurs or your lab and the flavors companies can yield a lot of really valuable data to push the industry forward.
Absolutely. So if you understand what are the flavor molecules that are required, what you are referring to is essentially genetic modifications that possibly need to be done at the cellular level, which can produce the required molecules which are eventually responsible for creating the flavor. So yes, the research that we are doing is going to feed into such kind of research as well.
I'm sorry, I just thought a lot of seafood tasted the way it did and tasted off the sea because it was from the sea. So when you take the sea out of the equation and create it in controlled conditions in a lab or in a bioreactor, how do you introduce the flavor of the sea again?
Not necessarily because only because it is coming from the sea. If you take a slightly reductionist approach of looking at flavor is because of all the undertones coming together and creating the final flavor, you don't necessarily need the seawater or sea to be able to reproduce almost exact taste or odor and flavor that you would like in the ingredient.
And to be clear, you actually don't need genetic modification of the cells either to get those kinds of flavors. So for example, Aleph Farms, which just actually sent some of its cells to the International Space Station to grow bovine cells in space, they're using non-modified cells. And Shiok Meats, the shrimp company we just referenced, is using non-modified cells.
Wonderful. That should address even the concerns of those who are against or have a thought against the genetically modified food. Absolutely. Get that.
And on that note, we'll take a short break, but come back for more conversation on Feeding Tenpalin. Welcome back to another episode of Feeding 10 Billion. We're here with Dr. Ganesh Bagler. Professor, could you talk us through, you know, the impact of your research, especially on health? A lot of taste prediction seems to go into making food taste better, but it can also actually be great for us in terms of diet informing our health. You actually have a database on bittersweet foods, for example, that has great relevance for any work on diabetes. And there's also a lot of work in India to be done because we have this double burden of nutrition where we have significant malnutrition in our population, but also rising obesity.
Nutrition and health are two of the major puzzle pieces around food, as I see it. And we have worked on both of them. The health part, we have database which we have created called DietRx, which actually gives you information of how food impacts on human health. The way food impacts human health is rather complex because body itself is way too complex. On top of it, food is interacting with it, giving rise to a variety of health consequences. And therefore, there have been always contradictory evidences coming about a certain ingredient or a food being good or at the same time being bad, right? All of these evidences are coming from experimental studies done either in vitro or in vivo, either at the level of animals or at the level of a test tube or at the level of population. What we have done is that gathered all of this research done over last 90 years or so across around 38,000 odd research articles published in the research journals and have put together a repository called DietRx, which is intended to give you an interconnectedness between food, diseases, the chemicals which are found in food, as well as the genes which are known to be interlinked with them, right? So this repertoire is going to be eminently useful in finding, in knowing patterns about what kind of food and food categories are affecting us in which manner and what kind of diseases are possibly coming out of by consumption of certain kind of a food, as well as coming up with strategies against specific diseases such as type 2 diabetes, for example. So if the idea is to avoid the epidemic of type 2 diabetes, then one would like to look at what are the food when taken would be typically working as therapeutic agent against diabetes and come up with recipes which might be useful against it. Well, that's the implication that we are bringing up with the kind of work that we have done.
And there is some precedent here with Ayurveda because there is some like home foods that we can eat. For instance, we're asked to eat bitter foods when we want to counter diabetes, eat more karela, eat more methi seeds. How much of your research sort of, you know, validates what's ancient wisdom here and how much of it is saying that there's much more work to be done?
Well, the latter part is more true, I should say. There is a lot more work that is yet to be done. We have not authenticated or validated much of what has been stated in Ayurveda. In fact, none. Because we have not started with any of the propositions that were made in Ayurvedic taste as an hypothesis and tested it yet. Although, there is some work that has been done by other research laboratories which would try and go and try to implement this and figure out whether it is working or not, we haven't done as much. But we do believe, I personally do believe, that many of the traditional practices that have been in ethnomedicinal or food practices that have been there, I therefore call these are health-centric practices, right, do have some value in them, right? So ideally, this should be investigated, but not much has been done in our lab at least.
Yeah, it's an excellent question and an excellent point. I think one of the things that needs to be investigated and it's going to be good for Indian culture and also the ancient Indian culture is using the same standards of evidence and science that are used elsewhere to evaluate food as medicine.
Absolutely.
Because this is a claim that's been made over and over and over again. I mean, we know turmeric combats inflammation. That we're taking that as a given proposition. But in what proportion, for what cohort of people,
yeah,
and is it good universally for everyone to combat inflammation? And is turmeric the way to combat inflammation for everyone? What if you have diabetes? What if you have hypertension? What if you have cancer? All of these questions have not been evaluated to the same standard of evidence as, for example, we evaluate medicine. Mm-hmm. So if we're claiming food is medicine, then we should be evaluating that. And I think that one of the questions that leads on from that for me is what's changed in the last 10 years that actually makes this possible? Because a lot of these propositions have been taken as true for a very long time. And at the same time, we're seeing huge advances in the advent of data and the advent of computing to be put to use to evaluate these questions. So what has actually changed to allow this to happen now as opposed to 10 years ago?
Couple of things I would like to point out here. One is that the body of literature which was done with evidence-based studies as well as controlled studies, has increased over a period of time. Although the experimental design might have been off question, that whether to answer a specific question in its entirety. Having got enough amount of this data, I told you about around 38,000 articles that we have gathered together. In my opinion, that's a huge data to put together, denoise it, to find out any noise in it and try to come up with robust signals of turmeric being good against a specific disorder under specific condition and what dosage. So I believe that's one thing, that the amount of data has increased a lot. The second, the new type of studies that are coming up with. So I would like to point to a personalized nutrition study that was done and the advent of computational techniques and tools like machine learning and artificial intelligence. In my understanding, collecting a large amount of data from a single individual, whether it is about gut microbiome, weight, the diet that one eats and the kind of exercise that one does, etc., the collection of this data has become eminently easy thanks to tools which can gather information from a body variable devices. And having collected this data, now you can apply data analytics over it and thereby coming up with specific predictions. For example, one of the studies done from Weizmann Institution in Israel actually looked into some standardized diets and its effect on postprandial glucose level, which means increase in post-meal glucose. And that was a wonderful study because the experimental design was very clear and specific, coming up with a couple of conclusions, which is that a given standardized diet is not clearly responsible in a cohort of around 200 subjects or 800 subjects for increase or decrease. You can't give general advisories for eating or not eating a certain food to decrease or increase your blood glucose level. That cannot be done because the evidence doesn't show that to be true. And the second is that having trained a machine learning algorithm over a cohort of 800 subjects, they could actually come up with this predictive tool which will make a better prediction as compared to the nutrition-based prediction that is being used even today, which will tell you, given an individual and body parameters from him or her, you would be able to tell which of the standardized diet he or she must consume so as to decrease the postprandial glucose level. And that's a beautiful study. And these are the kind of studies, in my opinion, which will shape the future of food and what we eat on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, I think it's really important because this is the backdrop against which really exciting new sectors like ours, which is plant-based and cultivated meat, are emerging. So the hope is that over time, all this data will become incredibly useful and we won't have to rely so much on these kind of one-size-fits-all prescriptions. Like, for example, if you look at the Eat Lancet report, which I think is wonderful, it does say universally we should be reducing consumption of meat and increasing consumption of lentils and green vegetables, etc. But that's obviously not going to work for many reasons, one of which is cultural. People aren't going to universally accept it. One of which is personalization, right? In terms of health, etc., we don't know necessarily what's good for each person. And then lastly, one of it is just like meat is tasty. People want to eat it. Mm-hmm. So we're hoping that as all of this data emerges on personal health, new industries like ours will emerge to also supplement them and give people the foods that they need to be in the best of health.
In fact, I completely agree with that. And our own studies done from DietRx indicate too, what are the food categories which are typically good or bad, typically. And even for individual ingredient, we have got those analysis done over a large amount of data that we have gathered, right? That indicates to such, you know, propositions about certain category of ingredients such as meat may not be exactly good against a variety of disorders. But as you rightly said, cutting them off completely out of the diet probably is not going to happen because of cultural and inertia. We have been eating it for such a long period of time and people are not willing to change to what seems to be a health-centric diet, right? Therefore, solutions such as clean meat and plant-based meat are going to be eminently useful in this context.
So when you have this overwhelming sort of database of data, how is that going to impact what we can decipher about how we're going to eat in the coming years? You know, this is also useful in food product development sense. It's also useful for people working with figuring out what consumers would like to eat in the coming years. It's great at predicting models of what would be our palate preference in the coming years. Can you help with that sort of work as well? And can you give us some insights of how it might pan out?
In fact, let me tell you, computational gastronomy is a blend of food, data and computation. And just to give a couple of illustrations of areas which have dramatically changed by the application of or by the blend of data and computation in a domain-specific manner are something like cab aggregator companies, right? The amount of data that has been collected of maps over last couple of decades by companies like Google on top of it, aggregators coming up and coming up with their algorithms and telling you about how to reach faster to a particular place have dramatically changed this whole scenario altogether of reaching from point A to point B, right? Given that, in a similar manner, what has not been done in the context of food is what we are trying to do in an ambitious manner. We would like to change the landscape of food, global landscape of food, with the help of data-driven food innovations. The idea here is to gather every bit of information that is available, like probably Google did with Google Maps, about food. Recipes is cultural information. Remember, recipes are cultural capsules which have been encoded over a few thousand years. So we are capturing cultural information. Further, ingredients are the natural sources, and flavors are the reasons why a certain ingredient is chosen or not chosen to be in a recipe. Further, you are going all the way up to the molecular level of the flavor molecules and their functional groups, the chemistry of the functional groups, etc. And then you are collecting data of the health impacts, the nutrition that it is adding to the diet. And that is where I would like to touch upon, how do you make our food more nutritious while eating a certain recipe? Even that question can be potentially answered with this. By collecting all of this plethora of data and applying techniques, algorithms, and data mining strategies, we can come up with answers to many of the questions that you were pointing to.
So, Dr. Bagla, this has been really fascinating as always. I wanted to ask a question about how entrepreneurs or other researchers or large companies even can work with your lab and access a lot of this data and create innovative food products from it.
I'm first of all astonished to be standing at this point, at this juncture, where I can see that data-driven food innovations are a possibility in the first place. Because when I started this work, when I was in IIT Jodhpur, it was absolute serendipity. Having said that, having worked on for last 5 years on this topic, I believe we have large amount of data analytics done over it, and having worked on various components of food, recipes, nutrition, flavor, and health part of it, there are many companies and entrepreneurs who would like to work with us. So the way to approach us would be to have a specific problem to solve and to approach us for solving it, either by taking analytic help in analytics of the data or by seeking for data that we have with us, and we are making it available to some of these entrepreneurs as well for non-commercial purposes. And if they are obviously wanting to use it for commercial purposes, they would have to deal it slightly differently. But one of the agendas that we have kept in our lab very clear is that this is a new field. And the field would not grow unless you keep data and algorithms open as much as possible. So the flavor data, for example, the recipes data and other data, the health related data, we have kept it open for people to investigate, and a lot of entrepreneurs are already using it.
It's a huge part of the growth of any sector is to have open access data available to create a platform for entrepreneurship and to create a platform for the advancement of science. And I think that what you're doing is truly admirable. So if someone wants to reach out to you, how do they do that?
Well, I would request them to write an email to me. They could write to me on ganesh.bagler@gmail.com. And I would be very happy to respond to them. And if they give the context of they having heard me on this podcast, that would help me better in identifying them and thereby responding them accordingly.
Okay, just one final question before we wrap up. Our podcast is called Feeding 10 Billion. We're looking at everything from a 2050 lens. So your work impacts a range of things like food design and pairings and recipe generation, disease countering, dietary interventions. You are possibly uniquely placed to tell us, what will we eat in the year 2050?
Well, that's a very interesting question. It is always difficult to make predictions about the future. But nonetheless, I'll take my shot at that. What I believe is that we did not believe that short-term weather predictions would be possible until two decades back. We did not believe that solutions like Uber would be available. We did not believe that reservations could be made online and we didn't have to go through the hassles of standing in the queue for railway reservations. All that is happening within a matter of a couple of decades. I believe that the food is going to change very soon, and data is the future of the food. And we would have to get into this mode where using data, data analytics, along with experimental tools that which are going to help us in collecting this data, are going to take us in a direction where A, we will be creating innovations in food of all sorts, including the kind of innovations that we have been partly talking about, that of plant-based meat and clean meat, etc. We would be creating innovations of the food. Secondly, we possibly will also be creating novel recipes which haven't been heard so far. Mm. That's one of the angles that we're working in our lab. We kind of call it a Turing test for chefs. Can we actually generate recipes from, just imagine, for example, I have a famous analogy for this. People working in machine learning and artificial intelligence have been trying to recreate a Shakespearean text, for example, or they have been trying to create a poem of a famous poet, for example, or even trying to work on the music of A.R. Rahman. I call it A.I. Rahman, the artificial intelligent Rahman. Can we do those things? That's what people are working on. In a similar manner, in our lab, having collected a huge amount of recipes data and various components of it, one of the things that we are trying to generate is new recipes. And these recipes in future, by 2050 is way too far, I believe would be cooked by machines at your home. Right? I am hoping for a brighter future where we will have from farm to a fork, a pipeline, a channel which is sustainable, healthy and ecologically sustainable channel where food will be created, which will be healthier, which will be pesticide free, which is organic the way it is expected to be. Then the recipes would be generated with the kind of data analytics technique that we are talking about. There will be machines which will be cooking for you, at the same time enabling you to cook if you wish to. But many of us would like to have hands free, and that's what probably would be allowed by these machines. That's a kind of a future that we are looking towards when it comes to food. And also, these recipes hopefully would be healthier than what we are eating today, as opposed to getting locked into food which is laden with ingredients that are at times undesirable, salt, sugar, and some others. Can we go towards a less processed food which is healthier? Is one of the directions that I believe by 2050 we would be reaching at. In fact, just to quote something as we are moving towards a closure, I started my journey as an aspiring astronomer. That's a story that I had told at many times, by the way. I'm trained as a physicist and then as a computer scientist, did my PhD in computational biology, and through a serendipitous path, I've reached to a place where I am today. I had heard about this quote that the discovery of a new dish confers more happiness on humanity than the discovery of a new star. And funnily, it seems to be coming true that I could not discover new stars by being an astronomer or astrophysicist, but seems to be that I'm at a juncture where I have created a niche area, this computational gastronomy and data-driven food innovations. And at the same time, hopefully, I'm moving the world towards direction where we will be discovering new dishes, hopefully making humanity happier and healthier.
There are innumerable examples of computing and data making it possible to solve huge problems that were until very recently thought of as inconceivably difficult. In 2015, for instance, Google subsidiary DeepMind demonstrated that its artificial intelligence agents could beat human world champions at the ancient Chinese game of Go. A profoundly complex game with more possible moves than the number of atoms in the known universe. AlphaGo, the program they wrote, was able to crack a game that was thought basically impossible for decades because of the steady, relentless march of technology and computing power. Dr. Ganesh Bagler's work and the other examples he offered sit on a similarly transformative bedrock of technology, which is showing potential to upgrade food.
But while Uber and Ola have the foundations of maps and GPS technology, the foundations in food that will enable data and analytics to take off are still being built. Whether it's in unlocking the secrets of flavors for plant-based and cultivated meat, or even figuring out how to process millets and pulses into highly functional flours, there's a lot of work still to be done. As Ganesh says, there is still very little publicly available information in flavors, nutrition, and processes. Really, any areas where data can be leveraged for plant-based and cultivated meat or other frontiers of food innovation.
Getting to a thriving market is going to take investment in primary research to understand these foundations and open databases to leverage them. Crucially, it'll take talent from all corners, like data wonks and even people from veterinary and meat science who understand the foundations of meat flavor. It's a daunting challenge, but a huge opportunity. And we're glad to have people like Dr. Ganesh Bagler along the journey. If you'd like to hear more about Dr. Bagler's mind-blowing research, join us at the Future of Protein Summit on November 11th and 12th in New Delhi. The lineup is kind of insane, and you should look us up on our website, futureofprotein.in. You'll see speakers like Ganesh and Mark Khan, who have appeared on our podcast thus far, and also folks like Amitabh Kant, FSSAI's Pavan Kumar Agarwal, and Srimati Poonam Mahajan. If you like this podcast, don't forget to check out other interesting shows on the IVM network.
You can listen to us on the IVM Podcast app or ivmpodcasts.com. You can also follow us on our social media. We are at IVM Podcasts on Twitter and Instagram. And if you want to reach out to me, I am at VarunD7 on Twitter and at Varun5 on Instagram. Come ask me why.
And you can find me on Instagram as a dithering funambulist and on Twitter as Cryptic Caprice. Please don't ask me why. That's it for this episode of Feeding 10 Billion. We wish you a very happy Diwali and see you again next week.